Hello and
Hello.
welcome. Cool. Episode 17, 18, and 19.
Oh my gosh, we're late teenagers.
I know. Look at us go. Hello, everybody. I am Jen De La Vega, host of Culinary Word of the Day, coming to you from Greenpoint, Brooklyn.
And I am Alicia Book. I am coming from you from Long Island, New York. And I am helping out Jen today. Give her some good questions.
Yes, I'm very excited about the questions. You always have good questions.
You know, my inquisitive minds.
Again, as a recap, folks, you are listening to the behind-the-scenes show of Culinary Word of the Day, where we take the last three words that we have published and talk a little bit more about them, because in a bite-sized podcast, we don't really have a lot of room to tell you everything. And, you know, questions come up when we discuss these words. And so wanted to give us some room to do that here right now on this podcast that has yet to be named. It will be named by the time it gets published. But we had been talking about Latin words, right?
Yes.
So. I kind of forget what we were going down the line of here. I remember earlier I had said, oh, what about extricate or extract or, you know, vanilla extract? But it turns out there are a lot of CBD and pot companies.
They beat us to name. It.
I know.
Got there first.
So we were going down kind of a Latin dictionary route. We actually had a few suggestions that I would like to shout out right now from the Patreon. From Kelly, we have et yumology.
Oh,
you know, yum capital, et yumology. I think that's pretty cute.
That is very cute. Yumology. Ooh, yeah. Yum.
And we have another one from Ethan, langyap. I've been pronouncing this word wrong for the last decade. It's L-A-G-N-I-A-P-P-E, langyap. It's a North American term for, I had it up here just now, something given as a bonus or extra gift. Comes from Spanish from langyapa or Louisiana French, langyap. It's pretty cool.
That is pretty cool. That's actually like a very interesting origin story to that word.
Unfortunately, I've looked it up. There are several podcasts and podcast properties called langyap. So it's a good word. It's a really good word. I think we have to like make up a word. I think etymology is a pretty good start.
That is a good start then.
If anyone else has suggestions, actually, it will be too late by the time you suggest to us. This will have been published. But I don't know. We'll ask again via Twitter and Patreon for more suggestions before this goes to air. And then you will see the final name at the top of the episode, which is very exciting. Look, I'm talking to the future.
It's going to look great. It's going to look great.
It's going to look great. We have a little, you know, little logo for it and everything. Very exciting. Very exciting. My goodness. All right. So our next set of words that we've released are going to be, or they were, food thermometer, boiling, and stir fry.
Yum.
I love this trio of words. They go together so well.
Well, you have to explain to me why they go together so well.
I mean, we're still along the very beginnings of season two, where we're trying to cover the basics. We can't possibly cover all basics, but I think these are maybe some essential items and terms that you would need to know when you're first getting started in the kitchen.
I definitely agree with that. Food thermometer, I think personally, it's a little bit of a scary tool in the sense that you may not exactly know how to use it correctly the first time you're learning how to cook.
Sure, sure.
And then boiling, I think, is a kitchen essential, obviously.
Mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm.
And it's a safety essential sometimes as well.
Yes, true, true.
And then we can get into how interesting stir fry is, I guess, a little bit later. That one, I think, is a little more complex in a good way.
Yeah. So starting off with food thermometer, you mentioned a little anxiety about this tool. I get it. I totally get it. A lot of people are intimidated by it. It's actually quite affordable. Usually around the $10 range. If you want to get fancier, they go up to 20. And if you want to go to infrared, we actually didn't mention that in the episode. Those end up me being, you know, sometimes up to $40, $50. It depends on the kinds of food that you're cooking and how often you will need that sort of insurance.
So I have a question for you.
Yes.
If you were looking to buy a gift for a cooking enthusiast that kind of has everything, would that be a good gift for them?
Oh, perfect holiday gift for anyone that is getting started with cooking, especially if they're going to be dealing with meats or casseroles. Things that you want to make sure are cooked on the inside before you slice into them. For real, for real. Yeah, because, you know, once you slice open a meat, you sort of opened up the inside and release the heat, where you're releasing more moisture. So poking it once with the food thermometer or poking it a few times with a food thermometer is not going to mess up the texture or the face of it. Right, you know.
Gotcha.
There are ways that you can determine doneness on various things without a food thermometer. So there are a few tricks.
I was curious, before food thermometers became easy to get, prevalent, what did chefs do? Like, how would you determine some of this stuff?
Mm-hmm. So before the invention of penicillin or, you know, Pepto-Bismol or Imodium or any of these medical wonders that help stomach problems, chefs would use basic cooking techniques like boiling or grilling or cooking things over a fire until the thing was well done, until there was no blood when you sliced it. So it was kind of like an overcooking to make sure that it would not hurt you.
Interesting. Wow.
Yeah.
So I definitely did not have any idea the concept of undercooked meat, rare meat is relatively new. That's news to me.
Yeah. So I don't know when the scale of doneness was sort of put into practice, but you know, you surely would not hurt yourself if you boiled the meat for long periods of time. And this actually happens a lot in countries where there is still no refrigeration, or you rely on eating everything instead of storing it, or fermentation you know, kind of outside storage. Like, some places just do not have fridges. And so you would boil meats until they were super tender and there was no chance of any microbiology happening in there.
Stuff growing in there.
I mean, I'm sure people did eat raw things, but it's stuff that they know where it comes from. They've caught it themselves. But this is also how, you know, we as a people have evolved. Like, we learned not to eat the raw chicken.
Right. I mean, trial and error, probably, but thankfully that's, you know, generations behind us.
Yeah. So one way to cook without a food thermometer is to just go over. So that means cooking things to well done, boiling until there is no blood or visible like red stuff when you slice through a meat, like especially chicken. You want the juices to run clear. There's also double heat methods. So you could, what's it called? You could sous vide something at a specific temperature and then be able to safely grill it to whatever, because it's already been brought up to its safety temperature, which is really interesting. There's also extreme cooling and like blast chilling. You might see that on Chopped or Iron Chef. There's something called the blast chiller. It's basically a super powered freezer.
That's so cool.
Yeah, it's so cool. And that can bring foods back down to a safe refrigerated temperature very quickly. Because we're going to probably discuss this a lot, but when foods are in the danger zone, which is 40 degrees Fahrenheit to 140 degrees Fahrenheit. This is the danger zone. This is where bacteria, microorganisms flourish. This is what they love. They multiply. So sometimes when you're cooking food, it needs to cool down quickly enough. If it's taking more than 2 hours to cool down, you are basically farming a bunch of microorganisms in the food. So sometimes you need to chill things very quickly. And one way you can do that is to use a blast chiller or a freezer, or this is a really cool idea for soups and sauces. You increase its surface area. How do you increase surface area of a soup? Like, say you have it in a pot, you put it in a hotel pan or a sheet pan and spread it out. And that way it will cool much faster.
Interesting. Uh-huh. I like that because we did talk about how soup last time, if we also wanted to think about it like a piece of paper when we wanted to add more stuff, when we overly pinch things. I like when we talk about soup in multiple episodes. That's going to make me very happy.
Yeah.
I think it's a universal thing that people like to eat. So this
multi-dimensional
is
soup.
It is. Yes. It is. I like when we can bring it back to soup. It's great.
So imagine now, okay, in this context, soup is a rolled up piece of paper in the pot. And for us to cool it down quickly, we unroll the paper into a sheet pan or a hotel pan so that it will reach the desired cooler temperature faster.
Interesting. Okay. I like it. I like the visual that I can picture. That's how I like to learn. It's great. I can picture it in my head. That's excellent.
It's amazing. It's amazing.
I also like that a lot of these words and concepts that we just talked about, we're going to be addressing later in the seasons.
Mm-hmm.
So if any of these words seem a little foreign to you, we're going to get there with the definitions of them. So that's also, I don't know. I think that's very exciting. I think
true.
Cool.
So for anyone working or wanting to get into the restaurant industry, you will need to know how to use a food thermometer. It is actually something that is required during a restaurant inspection in New York City. If you have any food that is in the middle of process, a food inspector will ask you to test the temperature. And if it's in the danger zone, you get points docked.
Good. Well, I'm happy to hear that, actually.
Yeah.
I'm glad that, I mean, for food safety purposes, I like hearing all the behind the scenes stuff that goes into food safety in like New York restaurants and stuff like that. I think that's very interesting. And I think it's good to know what the regulations are a little bit too, to be aware of them.
Yeah. It's always good to have a food thermometer on you if you want to get into the restaurant industry. And going back to your original question of, you know, is it a good gift to get anyone? And yes, surely. The ones that I recommend are more on the meat thermometer side, digital read. The glass ones are kind of old school, and I would rather, you know, keep glass away from food that may potentially shatter. You don't want to use a medical thermometer. Medical glass thermometers are inappropriate for in the kitchen because they have mercury inside of them.
Right.
That could get into the food, you know, so we want to avoid that.
That's a good reminder of not, you know, why the difference exists.
There are food thermometers that are just like one metal probe or kind of dull needle that you can stick into casseroles and meats. There is also one that has a probe on a heat safe cord. Those are really great because you can hold the monitor in your hand and watch the temperature go up while you stick the probe into like a rack of ribs on the grills, and you can leave it in there and it can keep reading. And so you're not burning the unit. So if you want to do more grill stuff, I highly recommend a heat safe food thermometer with the cord.
I was gonna say, this sounds like a lot of fun gadgets for people who may not be super into cooking right now, but the toy aspect of cooking.
Oh yeah.
Maybe really interesting, you know, so it's like a way to expand your sort of mindset on cooking and what it's really all about.
Yeah, totally. You could own a few of them if you really wanted to.
That's what I was getting at. Are they a little bit, can they be toys? Can they be a little
bit? Oh, absolutely. If you're a gearhead in any way, you will love collecting food thermometers. They're very different kinds. There's also like an in-oven thermometer. that is one, it's not necessarily touching the food. It's a different kind of thermometer. This one tells you just your oven temperature, because sometimes, you know, ovens are not digital. Not all ovens are digital. So you can't tell like exactly how hot it is in there. Sometimes the dial that you put it to 350 degrees Fahrenheit, sometimes it doesn't actually match the internal temperature of the oven. So it is good to have a little bit more insurance, especially if you want cookies or meringues or anything like that to get that really cool, like, foomf of heat. You would, you know, get a little bit of a little hanging oven thermometer to help you make sure that your heat is consistent. And I guess the last thermometer that I do not have a lot of experience with, I've never actually played with one, is an infrared. Do you know, have you ever seen one of those?
I haven't. So I'm a little curious about that.
You'll see this on TV sometimes. They are a little laser gun, basically. So infrared light is the heat that we get from the sun. That's the style of light. Well, there are several kinds of light from the sun, but infrared is the warmth factor. And so what the gun does, at least theoretically, is that it shoots a little infrared light at the food and it measures how much bounces back, which is pretty cool. It's like a digital read, instant read. You might actually have seen this at a COVID test site where people have been using an infrared thermometer to measure your forehead heat.
Okay. Yep. I mean, I think most of us probably have seen that in the last 2 years. That's something.
Yeah. So that is the same type of heat measurement. But again, I emphasize that you should not use medical products in the kitchen because the plastic is graded for different uses. Because if you accidentally leave it next to a stove, you don't want it to melt or anything like that.
Once again, I think that's always a good reminder.
Yeah.
I need those reminders. I thrive on those reminders. So, but the infrared thermometer is actually the one that sparked the gift idea, because that really seems like if you,
it's cool.
It seems really cool. It might already be on my list to get people for like their next birthdays, quite frankly, now that we're all being honest here. Cause that just seems, I want to see it in action. So that seems very fun.
Folks, if you have any recommendations for your favorite food thermometer brand, we would love to hear it in the comments on Patreon or on Twitter at Culinary Word of the Day or anywhere else that you can respond to us. We would love to hear it.
Well, I'm just thinking about putting some tools next to hot things, and I kind of like to talk about the boiling stuff real quick.
Yes,
if we
of
can,
course.
If we can.
Oh, we have time.
Because like now I'm picturing like a big pot of boiling water on the stove. I've left spices a little too close to my boiling pots. It's always been okay, but there's been like once or twice when I pick them up and I'm like, these are a little too warm. Yeah. I was like, this wasn't smart. So let's talk about boiling a little bit and what that means.
Boiling is something, I don't know if anybody remembers this, but do you remember the Berenstain Bears?
I do. Yeah. I love those bears.
They, I believe, had another book that was about science, about matter, you know, liquid, solids, and gas. And boiling is one of those first basic things you learn when you're kind of a kid in science class. Boiling is essentially when a liquid becomes a gas, or the process of. It's not instantaneous. That's vaporization and sublimination. But boiling is the first one, or for most people, the one that you're going to experience first. Because what do you have to boil when you're younger, or when your parents, when you're a baby, they need to boil water to heat up your milk bottle.
Yes, I do. Get it clean, get it ready, get it nice.
Sanitizing. Yes.
Sanitizing and warming up at the same time. Mm-hmm. That's right. Oh my gosh, it's the first thing. It's the first thing you do.
It's amazing, because parallel to that, you know, you just mentioned the purpose of boiling water for a baby's bottle. It's very similar to sanitizing for the pickling process. You got to boil the jars, the lids, the sealers, and make sure that you have a clean environment for us to pickle things in a safe vacuum environment. And it's all actually for the same purpose. It's to prevent microbiomes and microorganisms from growing. You'd be surprised that so much cooking is about safety and prevention of foodborne illness.
I think that's one of those things I really learned doing a lot of these words or researching some of these words, is it really all kind of comes back to that. Like, there's so many different things that we do. It's just in the name of eating clean food. It's about flavor and about taste and mouthfeel and all those things, but it's also really the core of it is safety. But I have a huge question to ask though.
Yes.
Before we, you know, get overly safe. Salting water before boiling.
Aha.
I've heard different things. You got to salt before it starts. You got to salt during the boiling. You salt right before you add food. I don't fully understand what's going on there.
Aha. There's a big difference between boiling and blanching. Boiling is the act of, heat, like a liquid reaches a certain temperature and starts to evaporate into the air. So water bubbles, it boils. Blanching is salted water that is boiling, but vegetables and other materials are blanched for a very short amount of time. So like 30 seconds to a minute, or maybe up to 2 minutes or 3 minutes, but then they are shocked in a cold ice bath. So blanching has a finite time period. And it's salted water. The French technique is for salted water. Boiling, though, can be salted in the case of pasta, you know, but it is not blanched. It is left in the water for 7 to 8 minutes, or if it's very fresh pasta, 2 minutes, but it's not shocked in water to stop the cooking, you know? So that pasta is then put into a sauce with some of the pasta water and then sauteed for a final heat through and incorporation, and then served. So the difference is the time and the finishing move, really.
Gotcha. Yeah. Okay. It's the end game.
It's the end game. So salting the water is pretty subjective. A lot of people would say salt the pasta water so that you want the pasta to be salty. But sometimes if you have a very salty sauce that it's going to go into, you might not want to.
Okay.
This is why you taste along the way. You can taste the pasta when it's done or al dente, and then taste your sauce and adjust from there.
Gotcha. So it doesn't actually have to do with the physical cooking of the pasta. It's all about the taste.
It's about taste. Yes. I mean, salted water, I don't remember the exact science, but I don't think it boils faster. No.
No. All right. You know what? That's actually, if anyone feels differently about that.
Yeah, please let us know. Please educate us. We are but simple podcast researchers. but yeah, boiling is a great tool.
It's delicious because I throw my potatoes in there. We're going to stay in the carb kick for a minute just because, like, I put my potatoes in there. You know, get them softened up before we're going to mash them, or I guess just mashing them really is what you do to potatoes. But is there, and I don't really think too far out of the box, but is there anything else that is really good boiled? Like, do you take anything else that you would put in there and you'd be like, I could boil this first. And then I don't know. Can you throw something on the grill after it's boiled?
Oh, like yeah. Parboiling is what that's called.
Oh, okay. All right.
Because you are partially cooking it.
Gotcha. That makes sense. That makes a lot of sense.
You would parboil things to sort of jumpstart the cooking process. So like potatoes, you wouldn't necessarily grill potatoes straight out on the grill. Mm-hmm. Parboiling will cut down on that grill time so that, you know, you can eat whenever you want to. It's usually for tougher foods. So you would parboil things that need a little bit of a head start.
Okay. I could have a lot of questions with this, but I'm going to try to condense it. Would this be something you would want to use if, like, say you're having a party and you're trying to cook you're having a barbecue in the summer and you're cooking different meats on the grill? Would you maybe parboil like a bigger steak so you can cook burgers and your steak at the same time? Would that make sense?
It might not be steak, because steak is a smaller cut. I'm talking big,
Gotcha.
Big and sinewy. So things that have connective tissue or a lot of toughness, those kinds of meats, like a round rack, like rump or a pork shoulder, those things need to be broken down a little bit more before they hit the grill.
Interesting. Okay.
Or you can, you know, spend all day just slow smoking that over the grill, because that's an art. There's an art to that as well. But a shortcut would be to parboil.
Gotcha. Yeah, the slow barbecue we'll get to another day. That's another summertime day.
There's actually another reason to parboil. In the example of crispy pata, this is a Filipino dish that is a whole pork knuckle that is boiled for a couple hours so that you get some of the fat off of it. So it's rendering fat off of it. And then it's also, what that does is there are cell walls that are holding all these, you know, all the fat cells in there. And then when the fat escapes during the boiling process, you're sort of left with the pork skin that has like little holes in it, right? Like little like globules of space. And so from then you can dry the pork knuckle and then deep fry it so it becomes super crispy. So with really fatty meats, a parboil can help render the fat so that when you dry it, it will get crispy. This is how chicharron is made. Like that crispy pork skin.
Yeah, I had no idea. Is that a long process?
Yes, it is.
I thought so. Okay. All right. It seemed like it, but I just wanted to double check.
That's a good question. All right. What else is bothering you about boiling?
Well, we've talked a lot about safety already today. But what else? I know you can boil water to make it safe. Is there anything else you would do? Like, is there anything else you would boil to make safe or drinkable? Or are there any other reasons you would get to boiling, like in a safety situation?
Oh, sure. Marinade. So if you had put raw chicken in a marinade, but there was all this juice left and you want to make a sauce out of it, you'd have to bring that to a boil to cook off any of that raw meat stuff in on the inside.
Gotcha. Gotcha. I've seen that a lot in recipes where they say like, bring it to a boil and then down to a simmer. Is that, it's to cook off all the, I'm still learning all the time, and I love it. But it's like a lot of these things, it's everyday stuff you see in recipes that you don't necessarily know why you're doing all the different stuff behind it.
So yeah, I think a follow-up to that is boiling stuff that isn't water. So you would do that to make reductions. This is a class of sauce or glaze that you can reduce to a different consistency. So like water, when you boil it, it sort of just evaporates into gas, right? But when you do other materials, you're boiling it down to sort of its base materials. And what's left is like most of the time a caramelization, which is a word that we will get to. But you can do vinegar reductions. Like, have you ever had a balsamic vinegar reduction on a dish before?
I have. It's delicious.
Yeah.
It's the best part of the balsamic.
It's great. So if you take balsamic vinegar and bring it to a boil and then simmer it for a time, it will become syrupy.
Okay.
You can also do this with wine, beer. When you get to milks and alternative milks, you'll notice if you've ever microwaved a cup of hot chocolate, you get what? What do you get?
The skin.
Yeah, that little skin. And that in the Asian cultures, East Asian cultures, is if you boil soy milk and you get that skin, that is called yuba. It is an actual dish that you can harvest off the top of the soy milk, and it becomes a sauteable tofu dish, which is
interesting.
Cool.
And is that, how is that dish served? Is it an appetizer, dinner? Does it get sweet at all? Is it dessert or all of the
above? Yeah, as flexible as you can think of to cook tofu. But it's just like a very thin sheet, yuba skin. It's called tofu skin.
Interesting. So that's boiling soy milk. That's so cool.
It's fascinating. Yeah, it's fascinating.
It is really fascinating.
It acts like milk, but it's a different substance altogether.
Interesting.
Yeah.
I've got a lot of things in my head right now. And I'm just like, how do I express them all appropriately over this medium?
Alicia is furiously taking notes.
She's not wrong. No, but that, I feel like that raised a lot of questions to like what other things you can do with like the tofu. It's cool. We'll come back to that.
We'll come back to it. We're going to do an entry about Yuba now.
I think it's worth it. I think people will be curious about what, I think some of our, you know, soy milk listeners might be interested to see what the kind of creations they can make in their own home with doing some of these techniques. Cause I know I'm a little curious now.
It's a fun little science project for sure.
It is. That's a good science project. Totally. All right. So I do want to talk about stir frying a little bit because I think we've talked about other things so far, including sauteing and the Maillard reaction. Mm-hmm. And I love that we're now talking about this. It's sort of like the next element in cooking with different reactions, I think. Is that fair to say about stir frying?
I would say it combines a few of the words that we've discussed. Yeah. And techniques.
I think it's also one of the more creative things a beginner can cook with also, or at least that's my opinion.
Yes.
I think when I started to learn how to cook, I thought I could stir fry better than I actually could. Let's first put it that way. I thought I was like really like a fantastic chef. I was doing this like great job with like carrots and peppers. It was beautifully done. Realistically, I think I was just like sauteing slightly and throwing maybe some soy sauce in and then called it a day.
Yeah, all right. That's a good start.
It was, you know, for a little Alicia, it was a great start. Let's put it that way. But I just think that's like a fun way to think of stir frying sometimes, that like it's sort of an easy-ish way to get creatively cooking.
It's true. It's so true. And you're right in connecting the Maillard reaction and saute. I believe, you know, you're using both of these concepts where we have a chemical reaction with the food that is hitting the hot pan, and saute, which is a cooking method where we are using the frying pan. But stir frying is unique. You don't necessarily have to have a wok, but most traditionally in East Asian cultures, we use, or specifically Chinese culture, we use a wok to stir fry. It's literally how it sounds. You are stirring the food at a high heat in a pan, and it's not meant to be a long cooking technique. It's supposed to be very, very quick.
But I also have another question about different oils.
Oh yeah.
Because once again, as a young and experienced cook, I thought like any oil could do, which to a certain degree might be true sometimes a little bit, but are there certain oils that like are really great for stir frying and some that like absolutely you should try not to use? I don't like to talk in absolutes when it comes to cooking unless it's
because there are tons of exceptions.
Exactly.
So I might be the opposite of a lot of chefs right now. A lot of them would tell you not to use olive oil. But if it's like an everyday olive oil, like Trader Joe's, you know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
It's totally fine. Totally fine to use. It's going to, with that said, though, it's going to evaporate faster than if you used a vegetable or canola oil or corn oil. You want to use neutral oils. The ones that are going to work the best are neutral oils that don't have flavoring. If you're unsure, check the package, because sometimes it'll say for high heat cooking or for finishing. So finishing oils are the ones we do not want to use for stir frying. So that's anything with a flavor, seed oils. Like you can certainly finish a stir fry with sesame seed oil or pumpkin seed oil. That's at the end though, because you are not, you would lose all those wonderful aromatic compounds to the heat. Like it would just evaporate. And those tend to burn more quickly because they have those aromatic compounds in them. Gotcha. So like a pesto oil would not work well in a stir fry. But if you had stir fried something and you wanted to finish it with a pesto, like the last stir, then that's totally appropriate.
Gotcha. You don't want to cook something out of it, if you will.
Right, exactly. That's why the neutral oils are so great, because A, they can stand up to high heat and they won't burn the compounds in them. And I mentioned this last time, but ghee also works for high heat cooking. So ghee, again, is clarified butter that doesn't have the milk solids in it. Because the milk solids, you can use butter, if you want to, but just know that the milk solids are going to burn. You have to turn on the vent, open the windows.
So funny story is recently I did buy a bottle of olive oil to cook with. It was a finishing oil. I did set a fire alarm off.
Oh no.
It did happen. It did happen. So I may praise myself as like an average cook, but I do burn things still.
It's okay. It happens to the best of us. Stir frying is really fun though, I would say, if you, you know, you got it all organized. I think, you don't have to be very organized, but what's cool about it is that you can just throw things in, toss, and then add your next ingredient. And then, that's it.
Well, like I said, you know, I started off with like carrots and bell peppers. I think that's one of those things you see, I think, a lot of at restaurants. Yeah. It's like a very basic, maybe like mushroom sometimes, broccoli gets thrown in, water chestnuts.
Oh yeah.
Sometimes thrown in there. But I've never really thought like super outside of the box with stir frying. Like I know the vegetables, but is there anything else that you may not immediately think of that tastes really great when you throw it in with some, like peppers, onions, some chicken and different things? Are there any fruits that might be good? I don't know. Ooh.
You might see pineapple on some Chinese menus. Yeah. I would say any hardy fruit. So like a stone fruit. So like nectarine, plum, peaches, a little bit on the firmer side, nothing too mushy. I wouldn't go for citrus because, unless, you know, you cut them into really perfect supremes, like those pretty orange slices without the rind, you'd be able to do that. Apple might be really fun. It's like the same texture as a water chestnut when you peel it. Asian pear. You just got to be careful that it doesn't get mushy, and you gotta flash fry this very quickly so you get a little bit of char and caramelization on the sugar, because fruits have sugar in them.
Right. And that adds like a different consistency.
And it's not weird to put fruit in a stir fry, because what kinds of sauces do we use with stir fries traditionally? We use like duck sauce, which is kind of like an orange marmalade. We use plum sauce. We use hoisin sauce. Sometimes that has raisin in it. So fruit is not weird in stir fries. So please experiment and tell us, what kind of stir fries are you making at home? I would love to hear it.
I'd be very curious about that. Like what's like a really great fruit mixed in with different things, combination, how easy is it and stuff like that.
Yeah. You ever watch that show Archer?
I do watch Archer. I haven't seen it in a minute, but I do enjoy that. Yeah.
Stir Friday. You remember that? Yes. It's in the very first episode.
Oh my gosh. Yes.
Cyril's Stir Friday. Yes.
I will lie. Most of the food references I think of are the ants, though.
Oh, that's how you get ants. Yeah.
That's how you get ants. So, I mean, that's my food Archer references.
My gosh. We love stir frying though.
I do. We do. But also I'm thinking about, I know I've seen a lot of different things about like next day recipes where like adding rice to stir fry can be easy or hard. Do you have to cook the rice first? Do you add it in? Everything cooks together? I don't fully understand this one.
So good question. In general, when you are cooking fried rice, it is recommended that you use day old rice. Because when you make fresh rice, it's still soft, you know, it's still sticking to each other. The reason we like to use day old rice is because it's separated a little bit more. It's drier. It will accept oil when you fry.
Okay.
When you're using day old rice, you make sure before you add it to a pan of any sort, you crumble it up with your hands because it's going to definitely clump together. And if you think of trying to stir fry freshly made rice, it's going to become a paste. It's basically how you make mochi. If you pound rice, freshly cooked like rice, it becomes mochi.
That's also good to know. Okay.
Yeah. Well, specifically glutinous rice is what you use to make mochi, but it will not separate if you use freshly cooked rice.
That's excellent. That's definitely where I've gone wrong sometimes with using rice in various things.
Day-old stuff. It's a good leftover dish. Yeah, day-old.
It's a leftover dish. Got it. That's perfect. I'm putting that on the list of things to try next time I get rice from somewhere.
Right.
I also, So I know stir fry is traditionally an Asian, considered an Asian dish.
Mm-hmm.
Is there certain countries though that like, is it different in different countries? Is American stir fry different than like originators?
This is such a good question. I actually don't know a lot of the history of it, but I will say that we do have a 90s fascination with stir fry. Like home cooking in the US was mm-hmm. made easier by TV chefs like Yan Ken Cook and Ming Tsai, these Chinese chefs were showing people how to do this stuff. And, you know, as they became more famous, we got brands like Le Choy and oyster sauce. And it's just really cool that there are now condiments that you can just like quick add to like mm-hmm. make a stir fry. But yeah, I don't know about uniquely American. What's funny about this is that a lot of Chinese food that we are familiar with is American. Like right. a lot of provincial Chinese food or East Asian food is pretty abstracted, like in American takeout.
right.
It is not, you know, what is really served like in China. Mm-hmm. Though we are seeing a lot more provincial recipes and like, you know, outside of mushu pork, broccoli beef, General Tso chicken, you know, that kind of stuff. That's all like manufactured here. That is like Panda Express, like Americanized like food. Chinese food. I feel like this concept, this 90s concept of American stir fry is uniquely American, but appropriative okay. of Chinese culture.
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. But I'd be curious to hear what is stir fry in other countries. Like,
yes,
we have, simmer sauces or mm-hmm. like starters. So like sofrito in Latin America, we have peperonata, we have caponata, we have, like sauteed peppers and onions, like mm-hmm. over in Italy. I don't know what it is in Spain. But folks, if you have ideas or life experience in this arena, please let us know. Is there anything that kind of matches the experience of a stir fry, but is not from East Asia? Really love to hear that.
Yeah, I definitely didn't think of some of those examples as a type of stir fry, but culturally a little bit different. But yeah, mm-hmm. they're all, the concept is kind of similar. It's, you know, sauteing vegetables in a hot pan to get them a little bit soft and then adding a protein and then mm-hmm. creating a dish out of that. And then maybe adding like a carb or so later.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Oh, that's like it's a very interesting way of kind of giving it a worldview. That's awesome. That's really
yeah.
cool.
Yeah.
Love that.
My goodness.
Yeah, I definitely like love to hear if anyone else has like kind of a similar idea of like a worldview on sort of a simple dish with sort of basic ingredients that we are easy access ingredients, takes not too long to make and can feed a lot of people. Like
yeah.
what is sort of like your vegetable, oil, protein, carb dish that can kind of feed a lot of people? That's like a family favorite and it's sort of easy to make, easy to eat, tasty to make and eat.
Ooh, I love that.
Yeah.
It's a good prompt. And with that, folks, I think that's the end of this episode.
I think so.
Yeah. If you would like to sound off in the comments, please tweet us, CulinaryWOTD, on Twitter, or you can respond to us on Patreon, patreon.com/randwiches, and catch the rest of our episodes on any podcatcher of your choice, Simplecast, Spotify, Stitcher, what have you. Any final words for our friends out there, Alicia?
Not really. I just I hope to see some examples, though. That's really exciting. Very exciting.
All right. So. Well, folks, happy stir frying and goodbye from us here at Culinary Word of the Day.
Bye.